In the course of the war, there had been extraordinary experiments in collective management in nearly all the belligerent countries. It was realized that the common expedients of peacetime commerce, the higgling of the market, the holding out for a favorable bargain, were incompatible with the swift needs of warfare. Transport, fuel, food supply, and the distribution of the raw materials, not only of clothing, housing, and the like, but of everything needed for war musicians, had been brought under public control. No longer had farmers been allowed to under-farm. Cattle had been put upon deer parks and grasslands ploughed up, with or without the owner's approval. Luxury building and speculative company promotion had been restrained. In effect, a sort of emergency socialist state had been established throughout belligerent Europe. It was rough and ready and wasteful, but it was more effective than the tangled, incessant profit-seeking, the cornering and forestalling and incoherent productiveness of private enterprise. In the earlier years of the war, there was a very widespread feeling of brotherhood and the common interest in all the belligerent states. The common men were everywhere sacrificing life and health for what they believed to be the common good of the state. In return, it was promised, there would be less social injustice after the war, a more universal devotion to the common welfare. In Great Britain, for instance, Mr. Lloyd George was particularly insistent upon his intention to make the after-war Britain a land fit for heroes. He foreshadowed the continuation of this new war communism into the peace period, in discourses of great fire and beauty. In Great Britain, there was created a Ministry of Reconstruction, which was understood to be planning a new and more generous social order, better labor conditions, better housing, extended education, a complete and scientific revision of the economic system. Similar hopes of a better world sustained the common soldiers of France and Germany and Italy. It was premature disillusionment that caused the Russian collapse. So that two mutually dangerous streams of anticipation were running through the minds of men in Western Europe towards the end of the war. The rich and adventurous men, and particularly the new war profiteers, were making their plans to prevent such developments as that air transport should become a state property, and to snatch back manufactures, shipping, land transport, the public services generally, and the trade in staples from the hands of the commonweal into the grip of private profit. They were securing possession of newspapers and busying themselves with party caucuses and the like to that end, while the masses of common men were looking forward naively to a new state of society planned almost entirely in their interest and according to generous general ideas. The history of 1919 is largely the clash of these two streams of anticipation. There was a hasty selling off by the business government in control of every remunerative public enterprise to private speculators. By the middle of 1919, the labor masses throughout the world were manifestly disappointed and in a thoroughly bad temper. The British Minister of Reconstruction and its foreign equivalents were exposed as a soothing sham. The common man felt he had been cheated. There was to be no reconstruction, but only a restoration of the old order in the harsher form necessitated by the poverty of the new time. For 4 years, the drama of the war had obscured the social question which had been developing in the Western civilizations throughout the 19th century. Now that the war was over, this question reappeared, gaunt and bare, as it had never been seen before. And the irritations and hardships and the general insecurity of the new time were exacerbated by a profound disturbance of currency and credit. Money, a complicated growth of conventions rather than a system of values, had been deprived within the belligerent countries of the support of a gold standard. Gold had been retained only for international trade, and every government had produced excessive quantities of paper money for domestic use. With the breaking down of the wartime barriers, the international exchange became a wildly fluctuating confusion, a source of distress to everyone except a few gamblers and wily speculators. Prices rose and rose, with an infuriating effect upon the wage earner. On the one hand was the employer, resisting his demands for more pay. On the other hand, food, house room, and clothing were being steadily cornered against him. And which was the essential danger of the situation? He had lost any confidence he had ever possessed that any patience or industrial willingness he displayed would really alleviate the shortages and inconveniences by which he suffered. In the speeches of politicians towards the close of 1919 and the spring of 1920, there was manifest an increasing recognition of the fact that what's called the capitalist system, the private ownership system, that is, in which private profit is the working incentive, was on its trial. It had to produce general prosperity, they admitted, or it had to be revised. It's interesting to note that such a speech as that of Mr. Lloyd George, the British Premier, delivered on Saturday, December the 6th, 1919. Mr. Lloyd George had had the education and training of a Welsh solicitor. He entered politics early, and in the course of a brilliant parliamentary career, he had had few later opportunities for reading and thought. But being a man of great natural shrewdness, he was expressing here very accurately the ideas of the more intelligent of the businessmen and wealthy men and ordinary citizens who supported him. "There is a new challenge to civilization," he said. "What is it?" "It's fundamental. It affects the whole fabric of society as we know it. Its commerce, its trade, its industry, its finance, its social order, all are involved in it. There are those who maintain that the prosperity and strength of the country have been built up by the stimulating and invigorating appeal to individual impulse, to individual action. That is one view. The state must educate. The state must assist where necessary. The state must control where necessary. The state must shield the weak against the arrogance of the strong. But the life springs from individual impulse and energy." Cheers. That is one view. What is the other? That private enterprise is a failure, tried and found wanting, a complete failure, a cruel failure. It must be rooted out, and the community must take charge as a community to produce, to distribute, as well as to control. Those are great challenges for us to decide. We say that the ills of private enterprise can be averted. They say, no, they can't. No ameliorative, no palliative, no restrictive, no remedial measure will avail. These evils are inherent in the system. They are the fruit of the tree, and you must cut it down. That's the challenge we hear ringing through the civilized world today, from ocean to ocean, through valley and plain. You hear it in the whining and maniacal shrieking of the Bolshevists. You hear it in the loud, clear, but more restrained tones of congresses and conferences. The Bolshevists would blow up the fabric with high explosive, with horror. Others would pull down with crowbars and with cranks, especially cranks. Laughter. Unemployment, with its injustice for the man who seeks and thirsts for unemployment, who begs for labor and can't get it, and who is punished for failure he's not responsible for by the starvation of his children. That torture is something that private enterprise ought to remedy for its own sake. Cheers. Sweating, slums, the sense of semi-slavery in labor must go. We must cultivate a sense of manhood by treating men as men. If I, and I say this deliberately, if I had to choose between this fabric I believe in and allowing millions of men and women and children to rot in its cellars, I wouldn't hesitate one hour. That is not the choice. Thank God it's not the choice. Private enterprise can produce more so that all men get a fair share of it.